back. He's back.
I'm back!
All right, here we go. Get ready to have a good time.
Well, come on. What are we waiting for? Let's go.
This is exciting, isn't it?
No.
Yes.
All right, we're on.
Hello, testing.
Welcome aboard the Dreamliner.
Hello.
These are the names of the pilots.
Okay.
Sum Ting Wong.
Okay.
Wee Too Low.
Okay.
And Po Lee.
Whoa.
What the hell happened?
This was a nice evening.
Don't.
But wait, there's more.
Four, three, two.
Gary.
Woo!
Welcome back.
He's down on the phone.
I am proud of you, my man.
What is this? Ponderous, man. Ponderous.
He's Gary Meyer.
Hello, Oak Forest, Tinley Park, and Olin Park, Illinois. I got breaking news. Stephen Hawking, theoretical physicist, cosmologist.
Wait, what?
No, not cosmetologist, although I'd love to have this genius give me a mani-pedi. Cosmologist, author, and a guy who never met a black hole he didn't like.
What word did you say?
Recently spoke at the Tencent We Summit in Beijing. Hawking appealed to investors to back his plans to travel to the closest star outside of our solar system, with the hope that a livable planet might be orbiting it. Alpha Centauri is one of the closest star systems at 4 light-years away.
Isn't that lovely?
Hawking is backing Breakthrough Starshot, a venture to reach this system, within 2 decades, using a tiny aircraft that could travel at the speed of light, meaning such a system could reach Mars in less than an hour.
This will be an hour of music with no gimmicks.
Or reach Pluto in days. Mr. Hawking contends if we don't search out exoplanets, the Earth will become overcrowded and increased energy consumption will turn the planet into a ball of fire in less than 600 years. Stephen, I appreciate the doomsday talk, but right now I'm just trying to get through the holidays and get those Restoration Hardware catalogs unstuffed out of my mailbox. But hey, if you can figure out a way to get to Mars in an hour, I'm totally on board. Did they serve lunch at this conference?
And the world will turn into a ball of fire in 600 years. Now we'll break for some roast beef sandwiches. And after our lunch break, I'll show you some of the sweetest black holes you'll ever see.
No.
Now you're putting the whole station in jeopardy.
A developing story. To the world of hunting, a county in Indiana has been the scene of hunters falling from tree stands on 2 consecutive weekends. Sean Thobe was climbing his 2-man ladder stand. Hey, the only thing better than sitting in a tree waiting to shoot an animal is sitting there with another guy.
You sure got a pretty mouth.
Priceless. Anywho. Sean fell backwards to the ground and ended up with a back and rib injury.
God, that hurts!
Which, ironically, is what the animal he wanted to shoot would have ended up with. Turns out Thobe was wearing a safety harness, but it was not attached to the tree when he fell. A safety harness not attached to anything is just called a belt.
He's got a point.
The following weekend, Michael Lee ended up with a fractured vertebrae when he fell 30 feet from a tree stand. Conservation officers said moldy straps on the tree stand had snapped, and Lee was not wearing the safety harness. Moldy straps used to be my clown name, by the way.
No.
If you don't want to wear the safety harness, then you'll end up having to build a ramp up to your tree stand for your wheelchair. Isn't that right, Stephen Hawking?
Uh-huh.
Yes, and I would like to say black holes matter.
No.
Oh, God.
I don't think that's racist.
I'm Gary Meyer, broadcasting from Chicago. Islamic terrorists are like king salmon. Life is good until the SEALs show up.
But don't come back. Bye.
Let's enjoy the David Plyer Sunday morning mashup, and then let's all go out for blueberry pancakes.
You ain't got no pancake mix.
All right, Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. And yes, you heard it right. Joining me in studio is a Radio Hall of Famer who spent his early days WFYR, WYEN. He did overnights on The Loop in 77 before teaming with Steve Dahl for 14 years on The Steve and Gary Show, 8 years as co-host on The Roe and Gary Show, and in 2007 launched The Gary Meyer Show. 5 of those years were right here on WGN. And now podcasting every day at GaryMeyer.com, Radio Hall of Famer. Gary Meyer joins us in studio. What's up, buddy?
Hey, David. Thank you. Well, Monday through Friday at GaryMeyer.com.
Monday through Friday, yep.
Yeah, and I'm really enjoying that.
That's cool.
Yeah,
That's cool.
It's been a nice transition.
Well, I'm thrilled that you agreed to join us tonight, and you're no stranger to overnights. You did that yourself.
I did, and I have to say, It was one of the most peaceful times I've spent on the radio because I was in the studio. It was in the John Hancock Building in Chicago, and the 100-story big black monster you see when you drive in and out of the city.
Yeah.
And I would be up there by myself, and it was very peaceful. There was no management and anybody looking over your shoulder. And the listeners that worked all night were your solid listener because that was their schedule, 11
buddies.
To 7.
Oh, yeah.
I'd have a guy call. I work 11 to 7 at the 7-Eleven. I remember that guy. And they were there for you because that was their shift, and it was very routine and rhythm, and the rhythm was there every night where they would call in a lot. So we had a solid relationship.
I hear from Jimmy the Bread Guy at about 4 in the morning every single week. You know, so I've got some buddies
so
out
you
there.
Know that.
I know that, and people ask me all the time, you know, why are you doing, you know, you have a full-time job during the week, you're married, kids, you know, why are you doing this overnight?
Yeah, you know, I wanted to ask you that for so long. So now that we're on the air, tell us why you do this.
It's my time. This is Dave time for me to hang out with the listeners and tell great stories and have great conversations like this one here.
See, I think you're probably better off doing it the way you're doing with the way the business is now because you don't have to rely on it for a total living. And you don't have to put up with all the nonsense that's out there. So you go in and you do it and have fun.
I do my
and
shtick.
You go home and you have your regular job.
Yeah. I was a guest on your show now and then, always tied into the Broadcast Museum somehow or the Radio Hall of Fame. But I think we only did one crossover, and that was when I filled in for Pete McMurray when he was on at 7 o'clock on Friday nights. And I was probably more nervous than anything, like I am right now. Because
why are you nervous? We're friends.
Because I know, but I'm just telling you, I grew up listening to you and listening to you and Steve and with Ro and as host of your own show for as long as I can remember. I mean, since I was a kid. And those crossovers, which I so much love to do, that was a highlight, listening to The Loop and AM 1000 when it was Brandmeier and you and Steve and Kevin Matthews. And hearing those crossovers was sometimes bigger than the shows themselves.
That was a lot of fun because it got me ready to do the show.
Yeah.
It gave me a little transitional time, and we all had our puppets that we used, and it was just a free-form kind of transition from one show to the other.
Yeah.
And a lot of people comment on how they liked that moment.
Yeah.
And some of those crossovers went for a half hour.
I know they did.
Yeah.
I know they did, which is so rare. And that crossover is what paired you and Steve together because you were doing overnights, right?
Right. Yeah. Right. That's how that happened. I was doing all nights at The Loop in Chicago, or WLUP as it's referred to sometimes. And I loved that shift, as I said. And then the station was sold, and then they brought in Steve, and I was ending at 6. He was starting at 6, and I said something, and then he said, hey, let's work that out. I want to continue along that line. And then somebody in management, after a week, said, hey, I think you two should work together, and that's how that happened.
And that's what happened.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was looking at some statistics because, you know, average radio listener today listens to about 96 minutes of radio. And that's random, jumping in and out of conversations all day. That is not one continual conversation you're listening to. But back then, and again, I was in high school at the time, but I grew up a little bit at the end of the Larry Lujack WLS kind of thing, but I really was a Loop guy and an AM 1000 guy, and I was a loyal listener. And that radio, much like WGN, is you turn on that radio at 6 o'clock in the morning, and you really never turned it off, and you never stopped listening, no matter what you were doing. You were working, you were driving. I mean, that's what we did. We were like part of you guys. You
know? It was a moment where we caught a wave, and Chicago had not had anything like that.
Right.
And we filled something that was needed, apparently, and it worked.
I saw and I told you about this once over dinner, that I saw an interview online on Lee Phillips' Noon Break with you and Steve. Mm-hmm. And Lee didn't know what to make of you two and was trying to laugh along the way, but I don't think she understood half the things you guys were talking about. And she said, you must be in management's office a lot. I'm sure that was the case in those days.
We did have some,
Yeah.
moments where we were always being pulled in and told not to do this or do that. But that was just part of the shtickle because after those meetings, we go back on the air and talk about the meeting and how they didn't want us to do this that we were just doing again.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so it just became, we folded, I think, just about everything we could into the show. of what was happening around us.
But they had to know at some point in your career, as your career continued on, that they knew that what they were going to get. I mean, that's why they hired you, right?
That's what we thought. But yeah. Then we'd have those moments where they hired us, and then they tried to reel us in, and we would think, why would you hire us when you knew what we did? We had been doing it for years.
Yeah.
But again, it was just all part of the circus.
Yeah, I bet. And really, you gave up pharmacy school for nearly 45 years of radio, right?
Yeah. I had to grab onto something. I was one of those people that didn't know what they wanted to do when they got out of high school and then go into college. And I was working at a pharmacy. And I just thought, well, there's a young guy here who's a pharmacist. He seems to be happy. He's making money. I'll do that. And that sounded good until I started doing the schooling, and it was way over my head.
Yeah.
In fact, if I applied today, I would never get in because it was a lot looser apparently back then or something, but I would never get in now.
So what of radio appealed to you? Like, how did you even get into
because
that?
Because I was listening to radio, as we all did in our youth, and I heard, as you mentioned him, Larry Lujack. I don't know. Some people might not even know who he is anymore, but this was a guy who I really liked because he was very sarcastic, and it was unlike anything else I had heard on the radio before he arrived in Chicago. And he had this feature called the Clunk Letter of the Day, where he would read a listener's letter. In tandem with that, he would also talk about being reincarnated as a butterfly. In fact, now that he's dead, I have to be aware that he might be out there as a butterfly if someone or one of them lands on me. And I saw this dead – I've told this story a lot. Maybe some people haven't heard it. But
please.
I saw this dead monarch butterfly on our lawn, and I thought, I'm going to send this to Larry and write a note that I think I killed one of his relatives. Because I was listening and picking up those little idiosyncrasies of what he was into, and I thought, well, that might grab something. So I did that, and a few days later, sure enough, I'm at the drugstore working. I was a cashier. I was working at this drugstore in Oak Forest, and I hear... Well, a friend of mine called the drugstore because he heard Larry say, I'm going to read, because I told some friends of mine I'd sent the letter. This friend of mine called the drugstore and said, hey, I just heard Larry say he's going to read a letter from some idiot in Oak Forest, Illinois, who sent him a dead butterfly. Well, I thought, that's me.
It's karma,
so
right?
So I had the pharmacist turn off the beautiful music that they would play in the drugstore and put on, I think it was on WLS at that point.
Okay.
And sure enough, he read my letter and just made fun of me. And I thought, this is the greatest thing that ever happened to me.
All right.
My material, Larry Lujack is making fun of me. And that was,
hello,
as Oprah would say, my aha moment.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, I don't know how to get into that business, but if I can somehow get into that business, that's what I want to do. But I had still the pharmacy school to go through and fall out of and all that. And then I worked construction for 2 years after that because...
Okay, so this was still a little far off.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
So the letter was read in 69. I didn't start in radio until 73.
Okay.
And there was that, like I said, that twist and turn of pharmacy school and then working construction to get some money in the bank.
Yeah.
And then I looked, okay, now how do I get into radio? And I looked in what was now... It's obsolete. The yellow pages.
Yeah.
Do we have phone books anymore? And there were
They still get dropped off. I don't know who pays for them and who's making money off
them.
They
go right into recycling. Who uses those?
Nobody.
Back then, that's where you look for stuff. Yeah. And I thought, did they have broadcasting schools in the yellow pages? And sure enough, they had three or four in Chicago. And I picked one and started going. And then I met a guy teaching there who helped me get a job, and it just started from that point on.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then The Loop was probably the big one that you
I started at this station called WFYR.
Yep.
It was all automated and all oldies, and I would just plug the machine in for 4 hours a night. I worked all nights there, too. And that was – or I'd record the news and the weather and plug it into the machine. That was radio. And I thought, great, I got a job in radio after a few months of just starting. I'm not complaining.
Yeah, right.
But I wanted to be on the radio, and I heard – a station out in the suburbs was hiring, and I went out there and got hired at WYEN.
Okay.
Spent 3 years there and honed my craft. Okay. Although, thank God, the internet wasn't around then because there are no records of this. Now all this
You're happy about that. Yeah.
This stuff follows you around forever.
It does.
And I was lucky enough to have that section of my career where it was probably really bad.
Okay.
There's no record of it.
So when you were doing overnights, how long was that shift on The Loop?
On The Loop, it was 4 hours, 2 a.m. to 6 a.m.
Okay, all right. And did you get to talk much, or was it really
I thought
it's overnight. I thought you'd maybe have a little more freedom to have a conversation.
We played the classic rock, your Uriah Heep.
Yeah, yeah.
your Zeppelin,
yeah.
your Stones.
Yeah.
But there was some time in between, and it was a lot looser because nobody in management was listening
yeah.
from 2 to 6 a.m., so I could maybe stretch the format a little more.
Sure.
And that was fun because I was coming from the suburbs to this big rock station.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that was a moment, and I was the all-night shift, happy to get it.
Yeah, absolutely. And then when you guys were doing, okay, when you paired up with Steve and stuff and you were doing radio, what did you, there was times that you were working for stations where you had to plug more music into the show and was less talking back and forth. I mean, what did you enjoy most about those days? Was it more about just talking to one another for 3-4 hours, talking to the listeners and engaging and so forth? Or what was
We played music every now and then at our discretion, but I got to be honest, after a while,
it was gone.
Yeah.
You never heard it again, right? Yeah.
Right. And they, every now and then, play more music. It'll help your act out. It'll make you stay fresh and all that.
It's management we're talking about.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's what we did. And then finally, we just said, wait a minute. It's a talk show.
Yeah.
We don't need to play music.
Yeah.
It seems silly at this point. And eventually, it all went away, and it was just 100% talk.
Which is really what you've done for 45 years. In so many different great incarnations, too, right?
Yeah, it's been, as the Grateful Dead would say, it's a long, strange trip.
And now podcasting, where, there's some more freedoms to what you're doing.
Oh, this is a whole different animal. And it got started when I was at WGN. They put me on their digital platform.
Right.
For about 6 months before I left, I don't want to get into that. But the fact is, when I got onto the digital platform, there were no rules. It was, this is the Wild West.
Yeah.
I'll never forget the first day I was on the digital platform. I talked for an hour and 45 minutes straight because I was so used to a format.
Right.
Even when I worked with
6 minutes, 7 minutes.
People in different formats, you have to talk for six. Well, you talk for six, and then you have to stop and do whatever their business
sure,
is.
Sure.
So I was so used to that for so many years that when I got onto the digital platform and didn't have to do that, I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
And to this day,
yeah.
now doing my podcast for the last almost 2 years, I can talk for as long as I want. That's especially valuable when I'm interviewing somebody because the rhythm is different and it flows in a much different manner. And I really like that.
Well, you notice we haven't gone to break. See, so overnights, there's a little more freedom.
That's what
As you know, too, I can talk for 20 minutes to somebody and not break that flow of that conversation or the concentration or the focus of that conversation.
And I know people listening think, well, why is that a big deal? But
it is.
This conversation put earlier into the day, we would have stopped at least once already or twice.
This would have been three segments already.
Seriously.
During the day.
We've talked that long.
We've talked
that's what I mean.
Already. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's the way it is.
Yeah.
That's how they make their money.
Yeah.
I understand that.
Yeah.
But I, at this point, enjoy that freedom.
You can kind of do this everywhere, too, right?
Have done it everywhere.
Yeah.
We've traveled a lot in the last couple of years, and I just set up the weird stuff to me in all this is having seen the equipment from 40 years ago and now where it's a couple computers and a microphone.
Yeah.
And to see this transition is pretty incredible.
Yeah.
So it's time at this point to look at things differently than I did 20 years ago.
Interesting. Interesting thought, man. We are here tonight to continue a tradition that Gary started many years ago on Veterans Day, talking about his father, World War II veteran Frank Meyer, as he shares his special recording about the 48-hour period battle in December 1944. And we're going to do that after we come back with radio legend Gary Meyer next on 720 WGN. All right, Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. We're hanging out here with Gary Meyer. I got to ask you, Gary, you know, we talked about a lot about your early career, and we're about to talk about your dad a little bit. How supportive were your folks, like, in your career to get into radio? Did they wanted you to be the pharmacist? Did they want you to get into radio?
I think they were supportive no matter what I was doing. I'll never forget the time when I told them I was going to drop out of pharmacy school. I know they were disappointed, but I also got the feeling, hey, if it's not right, it's not right. You've got to find something that you want to do. And they all along said, yeah, if you want to do that. And then when I got into radio, they got a kick out of that. So they really enjoyed the ride as much as I did.
So tell me about your relationship with your dad, because he passed away in the early 90s, right?
Yeah, he was 68.
Okay.
And a lot of it, I think, at this point was due to the fact that he was injured in the war. And then when he had a heart attack, they needed more parts to repair the heart, and they weren't there. So he lasted, after he had the heart attack, 6 months before he died. And 68 seemed very young. And
yeah, really, it is very young.
In my head now, I mean, with the life expectancy of what it is. But he lost an eye in the war. I mean, he really got banged up, and it was kind of tough to watch. And it's tough to watch a lot of veterans who go off and then suffer these traumatic injuries and come back. And if we don't support them fully, I don't understand that at all. And you hear these situations where the VA hospitals, there's a lot of red tape. And I'm thinking, my God, of all the stuff that should be priority one, that is it.
It should be our veterans.
Yeah.
Absolutely. There's a guy in there right now, David Shulkin, who we're going to talk to later in the show, who's actually made some pretty aggressive changes. And you talked about abandoned buildings and Gary and some other things. He identified 500 buildings that the VA owns that are completely abandoned.
Really?
That they're going to finally sell. They're going to find there's another 437 that are underutilized that he wants to sell the property and put that money back into the system to actually put it toward the veterans and the care of the veterans.
Oh, my God, yes. That has to be done.
Yeah, yeah. My grandfather, his name was Joseph Gendy. He was a World War II vet. He received a Purple Heart for his injuries as well. And I remember sitting with him, and he died back in 86, and I was just a kid. I was like 18 years old, so I really didn't get to dive deeply with him about war days or really anything else as an adult. But I remember sitting with him watching war movies, you know, or watching at night WTTW and watching not the movies, but actually segments of the war itself or whatever, but he never really talked about it. There was only a few times he opened up about his experience. Not a lot of veterans do. Did your dad talk a lot about it?
No, that tape that you're going to play is really all of what he kept in his head and shared with us as far as that goes. It's 14 minutes. But I think, and I've thought about this many times over the years, those guys come back and they just went to work, they got married, they had families, and that was in the past. They were not allowed to talk, not allowed, but they didn't have anybody to talk to about it because we didn't know PTSD then.
No, we did not.
And I think a lot of these guys had it and just thought, this seems like a weak thing to do if I start complaining or I have any issue with this. People are going to think I'm a sissy or whatever the tone was back then.
Yeah.
Which was really sad because I know a lot of guys from that era, and my father included. I'll give you a couple examples. The day he had his heart attack, my mother was next to him in the hospital. They were wheeling him into the ICU, and he turned to her and said, "Do you have the hand grenades?" He thought he was back in the war, back on a stretcher. Another day, my brother slammed a door. He was in bed. He jumped up, and he thought he was in battle again. We had an engineer when we worked at WLS who was in the Vietnam War, and a sound triggered something, and he went off. And the Vietnam vets, I think, were just starting to form the fact that there was something here that they had to explore, the personnel, the medical personnel, the PTSD syndrome that they finally identified. But a lot of these guys had to suffer in silence or they didn't know who to talk to, and it's got to be the stuff they saw in battle, and you'll hear this in the tape.
Yeah,
I can't even imagine.
No, and there's no treatment. There was no awareness of that, and you didn't talk about it back then at all. I mean, it's still an issue today where people don't know where to go to talk about mental health issues, especially when they leave the war and they go back to their families. But back then, it was even more so.
Well, I think that's why my dad sat down at the kitchen table. I'll never forget the day I walked in right after he had recorded this.
Yeah, so how did that all happen? Yeah.
So I went over to visit, and he was home by himself. And I walked in, and he was sitting at the kitchen table and had that little Panasonic tape recorder that was omnipresent in everybody's home. And he said, hey, I just recorded something. I want you to hear it. Maybe you can play it
so
on your show.
So he did it on his own. So he did it on his own first.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, oh yeah. Okay. And all right. I think what happened, I believe it was winter, was 1982. And I'm sure, and you'll hear it in the tape too, he was looking out the back window and there was a farmhouse. And that reminded him of what was going on in this battle that he's talking about here. And I think he just had to get it out. Think about what these guys saw. And after a while, you have to say something.
But 40 years later, we're talking about, seriously.
Okay, get this. About 7-8 years before that, he, with some old Army buddies, went over to those theaters of war, the locations.
Wow, so he went back.
To see, yeah. Okay. So get this. So they go to this house where these people sheltered them from the Nazis because they were outnumbered and they had to go somewhere, otherwise they would have all been killed. So these people put them down in their cellar until the Nazis left. They went back on that trip in the early 80s, late 70s, knocked on the door. The same people were living there when they knocked on the door that,
wow.
that saved their lives. Yeah,
wow.
That kind of stuff. So I think as the years went on, these guys wanted to go back. They wanted to have some kind of closure with what they went through, and I wouldn't blame them.
Yeah.
But they were the only guys that understood what they went through. So they had to keep each other in that frame of, I can talk to you. You know what we went through.
But again, 40 years later, I decided to grab a mic and a tape recorder and throw it all down.
And thank God he did. And the first time we played it, the reaction from the listener.
Oh, I remember it. Oh, I remember.
Yeah, people that had family, friends, whatever, that went through whatever theater of war, talking about how emotional they were. They were driving in their car and listening to this tape and just sobbing. Because it's so moving in that you can feel like you're in this battle. And the way he tells this story and I'm so glad I have this and that I can share it with a lot of people.
Yeah. What'd your dad do for a living after the war and stuff?
He had a series of dry cleaners on the south side of Chicago. I worked at the dry cleaners when I was – they didn't have these child labor laws back then.
Okay.
I believe I was 9 or 10 working in the back of this dry cleaners running all this heavy machinery.
That's where you got your work ethic from.
One of my favorite memories as a kid, he had the radio on and Paul Harvey would come on every day. And I would hear Paul Harvey and then – many years later, I got to watch Paul Harvey do a newscast. And for me, because of that connection of my childhood and with my father, I thought I was watching the Beatles record a song
head
because then I went into radio.
Cool.
So that was my memory of working at the dry cleaners. And then he went into life insurance for a number of years and was very successful at that. So those were his two careers, dry cleaners and life insurance.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So this tape, again, recorded 1982 at the kitchen table in his home, the World War II story of Frank Meyer about the 48-hour period of battle in December 1944.
As I look out my bedroom window every December with the little farmhouse behind us, my thoughts are reflected in December of 1944. Our division had just received word that the Germans had broken through our lines and had advanced 50 miles into Belgium. The whole mood at the time in our camp was one of concern and apprehension, for we all thought that the war would soon be over since we were now fighting on German soil. I knew that being an infantryman in General Patton's Third Army meant a lot of action. Headquarters had sent word down to all our companies to be ready to move out as soon as possible. The next morning, we piled into our trucks with our gear and was well on our way to the front lines. It was a very slow-moving process, for the trucks were bumper to bumper, and the weather was turning cold with blowing snow. We trudged along all that day, moving at a snail's pace, going along at about 10 to 15 miles an hour. And in our haste, we even had to bring the German prisoners along with us, because we didn't have time to dispose of them through the proper channels. One of the GIs I remembered even yelled out, "What are we doing? Bringing reinforcements for the Germans?" That day, the column moved slowly due to the fact that we took all the secondary roads while the armored took to the main highways. That evening, we stayed in a hayloft in the barn, and the temperature now had fallen into the teens. We covered up ourselves as best as we could with all the hay around us. And it was a very comfortable feeling after riding all day with the snow and the wind blowing at your face. It wasn't long, however, when the sergeant called my name to pull guard duty. Boy, I could have shot that sergeant for waking me up from that nice warm spot in the hayloft. It must have been around 2 or 3 in the morning. Time didn't matter much because you realized that you weren't punching a clock to go home. I pulled my first guard duty with a little Italian from Brooklyn. He was only about 5'2" and weighed about 110 pounds dripping wet. We went to our positions together, which was a machine gun emplacement. He was a very quiet individual, although I did try to make conversation. I nicknamed him the Little Paisan, and to this day I still do not remember his name. During the course of our guard duty, he pulled out a little gas burner from underneath his coat and proceeded to cover himself over with his raincoat. And before long, he had a steady blue flame going. We had to be careful not to expose any of this light in the event that the Germans were in the surrounding area. He warmed up our rations while I kept watch for both of us. That was the first warm food we had had for 3 days. I said to myself, "Well, I'm going to keep close to that little guy for the cold days ahead." The next morning, our outfit started out on foot toward the front. We were told to keep moving until we engaged the enemy, for at this point, we did not know where the Germans had advanced to. We had walked about 20 miles that day and took refuge that evening out in the open, digging our foxholes and keeping watch all that night. The next morning, we started out once again. I was trying to stay as close to my little Italian friend, because warm K rations now were very appealing to me. It wasn't long, however, that I heard rifle fire ahead, and our lieutenant yelled, "Hit the side of the road." I jumped immediately to a ditch covered with snow and laid there frightened with the realization that this would be my first major engagement with the enemy. We were now being shelled and pinned down by German tanks firing from the reverse side of the slope, which was from a little town of Hastert, Belgium. Our artillery started its barrage, but some of the shells were falling short into our own lines. This soon was corrected, and we inched our way closer so that our firepower from our company and the other flanking us would become very effective. Needless to say, the battle raged on all that day and late into the afternoon. The medics were hurrying about picking up the wounded. By nightfall, the few remaining Germans had surrendered, and the tanks had rambled off to the next town, which was Eschdorf. I was amazed at how young some of the Germans were, 16, 17 years of age. They were all dressed in white fur-lined garments, which of course was hard to see when they were blended in with a snowy background. We still had our brown khakis and made a good target laying out there in the snow. Our outfit was quickly assembled, and we were told that night that we would make an attack at about 1 a.m. Our objective was the town of Eschdorf. After a warm meal and a few hours' rest, we again set out to meet the enemy. We had not gone very far when the Germans opened fire and pinned us down. Off in the distance, I heard some of our tanks coming up in position. Before they even stopped, the German Tiger tanks had opened fire and made direct hits on two of our tanks. I heard the men screaming, and then there was total silence. I laid there motionless on the frozen snow, looking up at the stars of heaven. It was a clear night, and all the stars twinkled. At this moment, I realized it was Christmas Eve. Christ was born today, 1944 years ago. Peace on earth, goodwill toward all men. This peace suddenly came all over me, and I wish to quote from the 23rd Psalm. "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. And even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil. For thou art with me, thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of my enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil, my cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. At this time, Lieutenant Gisco called back to his men, and he said, "Let's go." We proceeded to run in a staggered formation over the Nola Hill. Now, the small arms fire from the village of Eschdorf became very intense as our whole battalion of infantry moved forward. I continued to follow the lieutenant, getting up and falling down at his command. Now the Germans started to open up with their mortar, artillery, and machine guns. We had finally reached the outskirts of Eschdorf behind a farmhouse, and as we were about to group with our platoon leader, we heard a tank approaching in the near distance. We all scattered in the farmyard and lay quietly as the tank went slowly by us toward the farmhouse and then toward Eschdorf. About eight of us ran toward the house, and the rest of the men headed for the barn. Fortunately, there were no Germans here. We went into the cellar of the house and kept close watch all at the entrance. It wasn't long when we heard tanks coming our way again and thinking that our armored forces finally broke through the stiff resistance. But to our dismay, it was the German armor that was in command. We all realized that our battalion was halted in reaching its objectives, and a handful of men that were in the outskirts of this small village were trapped. I now began to pray to the Blessed Virgin to save us. As I prayed ceaselessly, I closed my eyes momentarily and saw the Blessed Virgin dressed in black, throwing a black veil over us. We were watching the German tanks moving about the farmyard, hoping and praying that we would not be discovered. Daylight was soon upon us on Christmas Day. All that morning, everything was quiet, with the tanks in the same position, waiting to spit out the death and destruction. Soon I began to hear our artillery. The shells were slamming all around us. Then our planes began to strafe the whole area. This continued on for hours. Then we heard voices upstairs, and they were yelling in German. We hurriedly fixed our bayonets and were ready for what was to come. I continued to pray the Hail Marys as we anxiously awaited. We all waited breathlessly as seconds seemed like hours. Soon the voices were gone, and I thanked the Blessed Virgin. The shelling continued on through the night. We all knew that our forces were getting ready for another attack on Eschdorf. That attack came in the early morning hours. We could not leave our cellar, for we were caught in a crossfire. The top part of the farmhouse had now collapsed from all the shelling. Our planes began to strafe again and again. And after a long silence, we looked out in the farmyard and saw our GIs walking toward us. We all were overjoyed. The Germans had retreated. I immediately started running toward Hostert, and suddenly my eyes were gazing upon all my fallen comrades. My heart was saddened as I continued to walk slowly back to town, and then I spotted my little Italian friend, clutching his rifle in one hand and a small gas burner in the other hand. He was killed Christmas Eve. Christ was born Christmas Eve. As I prayed in a small church on a hill, my thoughts were with all my fallen brothers, for God had called them to their eternal reward. I wish to quote from John chapter 15, verse 13. And here is how to measure it. The greatest love is shown when a person lays down his life for his friends. As I left the little church, the command was given to move out, for once again, we were getting ready to meet our foe. I asked the Lord to calm my fears and grant me a happy death should it come. The season of Advent will soon be upon us. It is going to be December 1982. Christ will be born Christmas Eve. Men will die Christmas Eve. Nothing has changed. My fellow Christians, Christ is calling on us to bring his love to the world so we may rise above the animal, to the human, and then to the divine. This, my brothers and sisters, is my Christmas experience that our Lord wanted me to share with you. Please pray for all my fallen comrades and the fallen enemy, for we all are children of God. And may we continue to pray for peace throughout the world.
Pretty impactful when you hear a story like that directly from one of the greatest generation.
I know. And again, we don't have a lot of records on what they went through, and these guys are dying by the thousands every day.
Yeah. Yeah.
My father would have been, that was 26 years ago. He would have been 94 at this point.
Yeah.
And if you made it to that, but a lot of these guys don't, and they're dwindling. So some people have realized this and have gone out and started to get them on videotape or audio tape to preserve some of what they went through.
Did he talk about it anymore after that, or was that tape kind of the
definitive
story?
That was it. I think he got it out in those 14 minutes, and I don't remember a lot of other conversation after that about it. And it's unfortunate. But again, it's got to be so painful to relive some of that.
Yeah.
And
so.
that's why when we talk about these wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and I'm thinking, my God, when do we learn the carnage? And then you come back, and then we don't treat them the way they should be treated. Yeah. That's just sinful.
Yeah, and we have to remember all of those who fought and served our country on this Veterans Day. And I'm so grateful that you shared that with us again.
No, I'm glad you asked me to do this.
Well, stick around. Let's just talk about some life stuff when we get back. It's Gary Meyer and Dave Plyer here on 720 WGN. Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. We're talking to Radio Hall of Famer Gary Meyer. So, you know, I was just thinking, holidays are here, and kind of snuck up on us a little bit. The weather's been so nice outside, and then all of a sudden, boom, it's freezing, it's 20 degrees outside. And I think about the way the holidays have begun over the years, that, you know, it used to start around Thanksgiving that you'd put up the tree and start talking about all this stuff. Traditionally.
Well, whatever that tradition was is long gone.
Yeah. And now all of a sudden after Labor Day, you're seeing stuff everywhere and all over the place. Are you a big shopper online? You shop online, you go.
Well, you can't beat that convenience. It's just tough to go, okay, do I want to get in the car and go several miles away and pick up something that will be delivered to the house the next day or in a few hours?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you can understand why this is unfortunately sucking retail right through the pipe into Amazon.
What percentage would you say you shop online now? Ugh. I mean, we're a little different demographic, yeah, but I'm curious.
50?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say about 80% online for me, but I still won't buy clothes online. I'm still the guy that won't deposit money into an envelope into an ATM either.
I don't even have an ATM card.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Is that right?
I'm trying to hold back on certain things.
Yeah.
Okay. I did an experiment a few years ago where the battery on my cell phone cacked, and the phone was kind of old, meaning it was probably 8 months old, and I couldn't find a battery for it. And as the days went on and I didn't have a cell phone, I thought, well, wait a minute. How long can I go without a cell phone? This was a few years ago.
Yeah.
I went almost 2 years without a cell phone.
Really?
I know. It was a weird Amish experiment.
Yeah, because I'm going to tell you, if I'm without my phone because it's charging for about a half hour, it's like the jitters. It's almost like I always think about the cell phone, about like when people used to smoke. They used to get up in the morning and open up the pack and smoke, and they do it before they go to bed. That's what I think the cell phone has turned into. Is you're checking that?
Yeah, it's our audio heroin.
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
and that's what it is. And I don't know how I did it almost 2 years, but I'll tell you what, it was somewhat peaceful. For those 2 years, you're not available in the car, which used to be the thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Now you're not available in the shower. That's the only place you're not available.
That's right, yeah.
And I found the peace of that to be so great. But then I couldn't be in touch with people when I had to pick them up at the airport. You can't.
Yeah,
how do you know when they're walking out because you can't park there? And all. So I had to give in. But it was interesting.
Yeah, I bet it was.
Yeah.
I bet it was. But Amazon, talking about Amazon, who's pretty much taken over the world. I was looking at this. Their third quarter results, because I look at Amazon, I'm looking at UPS and FedEx, who's all living off of this, and then I look at the post office. Sales in Amazon rose 34% year after year to $43.7 billion, and that's with them buying Whole Foods. So that's even, you know, they're still making money. They've completely crushed Wall Street targets. They're hiring more than 120,000 people for Christmas, for the holidays. They already have 540,000 people on staff already. I mean, a behemoth, right?
The deal with Whole Foods, I heard, and you just gave the numbers, they paid, what, $15 billion for Whole Foods? And they made that back in a week in stock. So they basically got that for nothing.
Amazing. And they lowered the prices.
Yeah.
Which they did do. I mean, it's noticeable.
Is it? I haven't been to Whole Foods in a while, so.
Yeah, it's noticeable. So FedEx, and this is the other one, FedEx expects to deliver 400 million packages this holiday, represents a 26% increase. UPS is up. And then here's the UPS. This is the U.S. Postal Service numbers. 15 billion pieces of mail, including 850 million packages. They expect to be up 10%. But in August, it reported a net loss for one quarter of $2.1 billion.
That says everything you need to know about the government.
$573 million more than it hemorrhaged in the same period the year before. And for the year, they're going to lose $10 billion. Again, while FedEx and UPS are kicking ass all over the place. It's
what does that say?
Yeah.
It's a government agency that is dysfunctional.
How have we allowed it to be open as long as it has, just running the same way it has? It blows my mind.
I know. With the internet, as far as email and everything, and you have FedEx and UPS, how long can they go on like this?
So Amazon announced its intentions to build a second headquarters, and cities around the nation are lining up for this, 50,000 jobs. I'd love to see it in Chicago, but I've heard you talk about the fact that, you know, maybe there's some other cities that could really use that boost.
On my show Monday, I have an interview with the mayor of Gary, Indiana, Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson. And we talked about this because you're right. Yeah, Los Angeles wants it. Chicago wants it. Phoenix wants it. Nobody needs it more than a Detroit or a Gary, Indiana. So if Jeff Bezos has any compassion for people that need something, and this guy's the richest guy in the world now, did that just happen?
Yeah.
he has to look at those cities. And I'm partial to Gary, Indiana, because it's the neighbor to Chicago, and we've been living next to Gary, Indiana. I've lived here my whole life, and I look at that town, and I get depressed, even though it has nothing to do with me. I just think it's the neighbor. It's like if your neighbor's yard was all screwed up and for some reason they couldn't fix it or whatever.
Yeah.
And I have that feeling. Call me crazy. So I wanted to have this conversation with her, and I had been hearing about all these incentives that these different cities are giving to Amazon. And Amazon has a list of things that they demand to get this.
Wow.
Okay?
Yeah.
I heard that New Jersey was offering $8 billion in tax incentives. And I'm thinking, is there a point where you're giving more than you're getting back? And,
yeah.
And Mayor Freeman Wilson said to me, 50,000 jobs in Gary, Indiana, I don't know if there's a price too high that we can pay to get that.
Yeah.
Because they really need a jump start. The steel mill, U.S. Steel, that built that town, that's why Gary exists, because U.S. Steel built it 100 or so years ago. They used to employ at its peak, I don't know, what, 40,000
yeah.
people, and now
yeah.
it's, what, 5,000?
Yeah.
And you see the decay that has gone around Gary because the unemployment drives everything where it goes into the ground. You don't have jobs. That's why all the other stuff happens. She's very proactive. She's got the National Guard tearing down these abandoned structures. There are 6,000. I
wow.
read this, 6,000 abandoned structures in Gary, Indiana, and they're trying to get those out of the way. And you try to get something, and obviously you want to, it's like when you try to sell your house, you bake cookies and make it all look nice.
Yeah.
They're trying to cosmetically do something.
Just
now
clean
they
up
got
the hoods, yeah.
They got the airport, which has a runway that is longer. Their long runway is longer than the one at Midway, so they can handle big planes.
Yeah, sure.
But here's the idea that I've been floating for many years, and if you've heard me on the air, you've heard me talk about this. Put a military base in there. You need something big to jumpstart this town. And when I said that to her, she really lit up and said, I love that idea.
Wow.
So I might be at the ribbon cutting with the mayor with the military.
Yeah.
We've got this big body of water. You bring the aircraft carriers in here.
Yeah.
The military's not going away. It's the middle of the country. So I'd feel pretty damn secure if there was a big military base there. And that would spark Gary, and those personnel would come to Chicago to spend money.
All right.
I'm thinking big, David.
You are thinking
You've
big.
You've got to listen. You're not going to jumpstart a whole town with a Michael Jackson museum.
No, but I like your idea about looking at cities like Gary and Detroit when you're looking
for moving
business.
I think Jeff Bezos, he doesn't owe anything to anybody, but my God, come on.
Yeah.
You can do something so good because you have the power and money to do it. Do it.
Well, I got to tell you, it has been a thrill hanging out with you, and I'm so glad you said yes to come down to the station and hang out with us.
Hey, you're a good friend, and I've always enjoyed talking to you on my various radio programs. And this was a pleasure in that I wanted to, again, highlight my father's tape on Veterans Day.
Yeah, which is very cool, and I appreciate that. And we can find you, of course, your podcasting?
GaryMeyer.com, Monday through Friday. Tuesday, Thursdays are paid. Got to make a living somehow, right?
Yeah, you do, absolutely.
And Monday, Wednesday, Friday are free, so get a taste. Hopefully you'll sign up. But I'm enjoying this new chapter very much.
And thank you for, by the way, I have to thank you publicly on the air for hooking me up with Richard Lewis, because that was one hell of a fun conversation. That guy is so
Have you
so
been
neurotic.
Watching Curb Your Enthusiasm?
I have.
Oh,
I
my
have.
God.
This one was about thank you for your service, if you saw it this week. It was about Larry wouldn't acknowledge somebody that was in the service. But this is the best by far. They're 40-minute episodes, first of all. But they're brilliant, aren't they?
They're something that a lot of us have in our head, but we wouldn't say it in polite company, but Larry doesn't care.
I'm told I do that. That's why I like
you
this
do
show.
That.
It drives my wife crazy when she watches Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Well, wait till
she
you see the episode that you missed.
Okay.
Larry's at a dinner party, and they're serving steak, and he takes his steak knife, and he starts lashing it in the air and says to the party of about 10 people, don't you feel like you just want to take this knife and just jam it into somebody? How many people have that thought? David Plyer has that thought.
Obviously, I do.
Yeah.
Obviously, I do. Thanks, buddy. I appreciate
Thank you.
It.
Thank All you right. very much.
It's 720 WGN.